For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. We ended last week's program with the description of an interesting illustration in John Suchet's book, The Last Waltz, depicting the interior of a café in fin de siècle Vienna. Coffee, the coffee house, the elegant café became synonymous with social life in the capital of the Habsburgs. Chapter 3 of the book, Suchet entertains us with the story of how coffee and Vienna are historically entwined. Reading from his book, I find the following affirmation. It is possible that coffee was served in a café in Oxford or Venice earlier, but it is in the capital of the Habsburg Empire that café became a way of life. The Habsburg Empire traded with the Ottoman Empire, so the coffee bean, so prevalent in Istanbul, made its way to Vienna. Allow me to interject, in much the same way as the half-moon-shaped croissant did. Suchet goes on to give us a fascinating tale as to how and why coffee became so popular in Vienna. And here is one of the many reasons for the title of this new series of the programs, A Book, A Thousand Stories. Author writes, it is of course a legend, and as such has become embroidered over the passage of time. But a legend becomes so only if it is based on truth. And every legend has a hero. The hero here is an unusual character, a Polish street trader called Kolszczynski. Trading and traveling in Turkey, this man had become familiar with Turkish traditions and fluent in the language. 1529, Suleiman the Magnificent, declaring a jihad, failed to conquer Vienna, in the very heart of Christian Europe. After this failed attempt, the Viennese built a wall, the Bastei, all around their city, in order to preempt further attacks. More than a century later, in 1683, the same wall was to prove nearly lethal as the Turks, again attempting to take the city, waited out on the glacis for its inhabitants to surrender or to starve. The situation inside the walls was becoming desperate. The commander of the meager forces inside the city, Count Starenberg, needed help, and fast. The Duke of Lorraine, with 33,000 men, was camped on the opposite bank of the Danube, and King Jan Sobieski of Poland was marching towards Vienna, gathering willing Christian troops on the way. Several attempts at sending messengers failed, their carriers having been intercepted, and their martyred bodies hung outside the city walls as a warning. Enter the man who could speak fluent Turkish, understand Turkish ways, and could pass himself off as one of the enemy. Could Kolchinski succeed where the others had failed? Using his wily skills, Kolchinski walked through the Turkish encampment as though he were one of them, reaching the Duke of Lorraine to deliver the desperate call for help. Lorraine sent messages to the Polish king, Sobieski, and to other Christian princes, warning them that unless they rallied forces, Vienna would be lost, leaving Europe open to the Muslim hordes. Less than a month later, the Polish king charged down the hillside into the Turkish camp. Just imagine, the glacis outside the Bastei bristling with 30,000 multicolored Turkish tents. Imagine the smoke-filled air filled with exotic Levantine aromas and spices. Imagine the cry of the muezzin chanting Allah Akbar, while within the city the populace waited in trepidation, hoping for the arrival of relief troops. Taken by surprise, the Turkish troops were quickly overwhelmed, fleeing in disarray, unable even to dismantle their tents or to pack up goods and equipment. King Jan Sobieski became an instant hero across Europe and Kolchinsky a hero in Vienna.
The Battle of Vienna of 1683 was one of the most important battles in early modern European history. It was a turning point in the fortunes of the Ottoman Empire. After 1683, the empire could no longer be a threat to Christian Europe and went into a steep decline in the ensuing centuries. The battle saved Vienna and the Habsburg Empire, which became one of the leading powers in continental Europe. Hypothetically, having a take on alternative history, if Vienna had fallen in 1683, the great Viennese cultural flourishing of the 18th and 19th centuries would not have happened, and there may have been no Mozart, no Schubert, no Strausses. But what exactly is the historical weight of this event? That of the Ottomans was an expansionist empire, both territorially as well as religiously. Expanding Ottoman rule and Islam had been the pillars of the empire since the 15th century. The takeover of Constantinople was just the beginning of a long quest for control. In the contested Mediterranean Sea, from 1551 to 1571, the Ottomans took the port of Tripoli, attempted, in vain, the takeover of the island of Malta, but conquered Cyprus thereafter. Following the defeat in the Battle of Lepanto in October of 1571, the Ottomans halted their westward expansion and focused on maintaining peace throughout their territories. In 1683, the Ottomans struck again. This was not the Ottomans' first attempt to seize Vienna. Back in 1529, the Ottoman army had tried to take Vienna, but was repelled only 3 weeks later. The inability of the Ottomans to capture Vienna in 1529, and more so in 1683, turned the tide against almost a century of Ottoman conquest throughout Eastern and Central Europe. The implications of the failure were not only domestic, but also regional, not only political, but also psychological. The relationship between Christendom and Islam began to change. For centuries, the alleged clash of civilizations hung like an iron curtain between the West and East, a divide marked by civilizational, ethnical, religious, and historical differences, with the Christians attempting to keep the Muslims at bay, and, if possible, recapturing areas, most notably Palestine, that they considered to be sacred to their religion. In the remaining part of the 17th century, with Ottoman power visibly weakened, it became more possible for the West to claim complete superiority over the Muslim world and aspire for its elimination. That would be easier said than done. Islam was never undone, but the Ottoman realm did ultimately disintegrate, if not before long centuries of crippling ill health of a moribund empire. The empire met its end after the First World War. The legendary legacy of the Turkish attempt to take the Habsburg capital includes the greatest of Viennese institutions, the coffee house. The Turks brought the bean to Austria, but with it also came the real dread of the Muslim invader, branded into folk memories across Central Europe and the Balkans. To this day, much of Europe still sees Turkey in very much the same way. Arguably, the effect of the Battle of Vienna can still be felt in the current context, although surely not as a direct effect of the battle itself. Parallelisms could be drawn between the historical Ottoman failed attempt to get deeper into Europe and Turkey's long-standing and thus far unsuccessful endeavour to get in the European Union. This has been on the agenda since 1987, when Turkey first applied to join, and there is little to show that it will be affected anytime soon. Turkey has not had the best relationships with the EU, and some of the historical prejudice keeps showing through. The struggle between 17th century style European Union of the Holy League had the decisive say over the Ottomans after 1683. 21st century EU seems to be reasserting that fate. One can still hope and ask, can diplomacy reach a compromise?
At this point, Susha gives us an inventory of the immense fortune that the Ottomans left behind. 25,000 tents, 20,000 oxen, 5,000 camels, 100,000 bushels of grain, and huge quantities of gold. And hundreds of sacks filled with green beans that no one in Vienna had seen before. No one, that is, but Kosciuszko, who from his time in Istanbul knew instantly that they were coffee beans. When Emperor Leopold, grateful for his heroic service, asked him to choose what he wished from the bounty left behind by the vanquished Turks, Kosciuszko asked for those sacks of beans and for the license to open an establishment serving the beverage made from them. Thus, Vienna acquired, it is said, its first coffee house, its first café. The rest is history. As often happens, fact is fancifully dressed with legend, but it is a fact that to this very day there is a street in Vienna called Kościński Gasse, on whose corner stands a statue of Georg Franz Kolchinski, wearing Turkish garb, carrying a coffee pot and a tray with little cups. It was erected by the Grateful Coffee Makers Guild of Vienna. By 1830, in Johann Strauss the Younger's childhood, there were 80 coffee houses in Vienna and 50 more in the suburbs. We are now at the dawn of industrial life, when people will have more time for relaxation and demand more entertainment. Says, the waltz was taking hold in Vienna at just the time Johann Strauss's father was weighing up the possibilities of a solo career. The style and rhythm came natural to him. He played it, he wrote it, and the Viennese delighted in it. Johann Strauss the Elder was on his way to a dazzling career. His first big success was at the Spurzfest, where he celebrated his orchestra's debut at Vienna's newest and most prestigious dance hall, the Spurl, to which, eventually, Strauss Jr. was to dedicate much and varied music. Quote from John Suchet's writing. Writing with characteristic hyperbole, a certain Richard Wagner, who visited Vienna in the summer of 1832, wrote, "I shall never forget the extraordinary playing of Johann Strauss, who made the audiences almost frantic with delight." And Frédéric Chopin noted, "Lana, Strauss, and their waltzes obscure everything." But what of Johann Strauss's private life? As his popularity grew, so did his family. Less than 2 years after Johann Jr.'s birth came a second son, Josef, followed at 2 yearly intervals by two girls, Anna and Therese, and by a fifth sibling, who only lived a few months, and finally, in 1835, by the sixth and last child, Eduard. This growing family was the cause for frequent house moves, as larger accommodation was needed and as the family fortune improved. The Strausses moved to better quality areas in town. We have on page 23 of The Last Waltz an image of the elegant mansion in Lerchenfelder Strasse, where Johann Strauss the Younger was born in 1825. Thank you. Strauss Sr.'s activity, his sparkling stage presence, and the flamboyance with which he led his orchestra took him to perform down the Danube to Pest, where he triumphed with the first stroke of his bow. A prelude to his being invited to perform in Berlin with his orchestra before the King of Prussia and his distinguished guests, the Tsar and Empress of Russia. The return trip to Vienna saw the orchestra performing in Leipzig, Dresden and Prague. The following year, they undertook a four-month tour performing in the major cities of Central Europe and only getting back to Vienna in time for New Year's Eve 1835. Everywhere the orchestra played, the audience seemed to relish a feeling of liberation, as if they had been given permission to get up and dance, smile, laugh, sing, shout, drink, and dance their troubles away. The story continues next week. Allow me to thank Gerald Fennec and Simone Azzopardi, as well as the technicians from Campus FM. Till then, my friends, goodbye.